Welcome to the Cinemondo podcast with Kathy, Mark, and Burke, talking about movies, horror, sci-fi, unusual, unknown, forgotten, underappreciated, always interesting.
Always. and that was Burke doing the introduction, by the way.
That's Mark talking just now. And it's Kathy right here.
I'm Burke.
I'm Kathy.
I'm Mark.
That was not properly said.
We should do the Three Stooges hello thing. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Oh, no. Oh, no. We have to do that again.
Hello. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
God, that's stupid.
That is so bad.
I'm a victim of circumstance.
Now I'm kind of singing on tape. I did not want that.
Oh, my God.
We can just edit that out.
This
later.
Is where people just stop listening to the show. They're just like, okay, I've had it. I've had it. It's it.
What happened to all the 5-star reviews? Yeah. After that episode, I'm like, woof.
The senior review, it all fell off the cliff. I don't know what happened.
That episode where they started singing like the Three Stooges.
Well, we're evolving. And, you know, I'm going to do my juggling, which should be really fun.
I thought our podcast needed more singing.
I'll bring in my tambourine.
We're doing more of a variety show thing, kind of like, you know, Glenn Campbell's Good Time Hour.
Oh, you get to listen to people juggling.
Yeah. And us going, oh my God, he's juggling 12 now.
Oh God. Well, how are you guys doing?
Are we drunk or what? What happened?
Yeah, what's going on? All right.
We do like 25 podcasts in a row, just to let you know.
Nice. Yeah. Hardly. Huh.
No, just kidding.
25 in a row, shit.
Well, we're actually talking about something today that we've talked about before. We're going to talk about movies.
No, we're not.
And we've all talked about Stephen King. We keep bringing Stephen King up. It's like the thing we won't stop talking about. But we're going to talk about a filmmaker that we all really like, who I think I kind of put him in a similar category with Stephen King, where he's just so good at storytelling. And his stories are very distinctly his. You can watch one of this guy's movies and you can just go, okay, this is one of his movies, without question. And he has certain things that, like a lot of great artists, he has certain things that he's kind of obsessed with that kind of borderline on a little bit obsessive in some ways when you watch the body of work that he has. And the word body is a clue to who
body.
I'm talking about.
Body. Yeah, let's talk about body horror.
Body horror. The master of body horror, and his name is?
David Cronenberg.
Yes. He's one of our favorite filmmakers. I guess you would say he was a horror movie filmmaker, but his films kind of go into weird territories, and a lot of it is science fiction, I think. And the movies that we're going to talk about today, they're both directed by David Cronenberg, but one of them was written by Stephen King.
And he directed the other movie that we're going to talk about, Dead Ringers.
Dead Ringers.
Dead Zone. It's all dead.
Well, let's talk Dead Zone first, because that came earlier.
Yeah, Dead Zone is a movie that just, I think, when you talk about Stephen King, his books are all great. They're mostly great. There's a couple that I don't like as much as I like others, but mostly his books are great. But
they all at least have great parts in them.
I'm going to read it. I'm going to read his books, but I'll tell you something that a lot of people know. When you say a movie made from a Stephen King book, you're not necessarily talking about a great movie.
I don't know if people are aware that not all Stephen King movies are good.
Some of his movies are just awful, and some of them are just great. Some of them get it. Some of them get his thing.
What's the worst?
Yeah, what's the worst Stephen King
movie? The one that he directed, I think.
Maximum Overdrive with Charlie Sheen is just unfortunate.
Even though it's a close tie with the second Shining version that was on TV.
I never saw that one.
Ooh.
Yeah, I didn't see that either. But that was a toughie.
Yeah.
I went to the theater to watch it.
With Maximum Overdrive?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he directed that. You would think, you know, I was hoping, when I heard about that, I hope he's a good director. Wouldn't it be cool if he directed movies and he was really good? Nope. He needs to just go back to the typewriter.
Poor Steve. You know, did you guys ever watch Sons of Anarchy?
No.
I never did.
No.
You know? Okay.
I want to.
Get on that.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway.
I know. It's everyone, one of a million of shows that I should
everyone
be watching.
Everyone get on Sons of Anarchy. But anyway, so Stephen King has a really cool cameo in that show. Oh. I don't know if you're aware he's in it. But he gets to do like the Stephen King fantasy where he comes riding in on a motorcycle all dressed in black leather. And he's like a cleaner. Like he's a guy that cleans up a murder scene. So good.
That's great.
Really good. So definitely.
Is he good? I mean, is it kind of a put on? Is it sort of tongue in cheek? Like, oh, Stephen King, wink, wink.
A little, but I mean, it works for the absurdity of the narrative at the time, where these guys kind of flub a murder and they're desperate and they're freaking out. So they just like, you know, in Pulp Fiction, they bring in Harvey
Keitel. Harvey Keitel. Yeah.
So they bring in, get the cleaner in here. I don't remember what his name was on the show. It's been a while, but they call him in. And so he comes riding up and they're like, this guy?
Is his name something like Kevin Sting?
No, but it's worth
King Stephen.
Yeah. Sons of Anarchy is great and worth checking out in general, but it was a fun thing to see all of a sudden. Now I've ruined the surprise, but it makes you want to watch it.
Well, regardless of, you know, Maximum Overdrive, I mean, listen, I mean, everybody can stub their toe. You
I
know,
can't remember so. Last time. I don't think I only saw that once, I think.
I saw it once, and that's all they get from me on that one.
All I remember is a big truck in it.
But among the best, you know, we've talked about Carrie, which I think is one of the very, very best.
Definitely.
You know, everybody loves The Shining. And another one that people kind of forget about sometimes that I think is one of the very best,
definitely,
like in the very small handful of absolutely best Stephen King adaptations. And the reason it's so good is because it was directed by a master director, David Cronenberg, but it's The Dead Zone.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of a, you know, as far as Stephen King books go, it's one of the sort of smaller stories in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It's not a really big epic like The Stand or, you know, it's also not a
straight horror. I mean,
right.
You know, it's kind of a quiet story, more about, you know, recovering and
personal. It's like small scale people being able to see into somebody's mind. You know, it's kind of, in a way, again, it's another thing that Stephen King does a few times in his stories, where he has people who are able to read someone's thoughts or shine or get impressions from someone. But in this case, Christopher Walken plays a character who has an accident that triggers a weird ability in him, to where when he touches someone, he can see into their future.
And see, like, and some of it's even the present. Like, it's not really fully explained, because some of it's not even their trauma. Like, the nurse's house
right.
was on fire and her daughter was there. But he sensed it, even though it wasn't necessarily her experience.
Yeah, I think what makes it interesting to me, I mean, first I'll just talk about Cronenberg. It feels very much like an un-Cronenberg-like movie to me in a lot of ways. It doesn't have sort of that body horror thing and some of the stuff that he obsesses on. It's more of a mainstream feel to it to me. It's more Stephen King than Cronenberg. But also, what makes the movie work for me is Christopher Walken.
Yeah.
In the lead. I mean, so, you know, in later years, Christopher Walken is sort of like parodied and, you know, sort of, you know, that's a Christopher Walken type of performance. But this one is much more subdued and realistic, and he's a real character.
He plays a really normal person.
He's a school teacher, and, you know, he's in love with, you know, his girlfriend, and then he gets into this accident, and he wakes up 5 years later.
Yeah, he's in a coma.
So he's lost everything. He doesn't have his job.
He lost his love.
He doesn't have his girlfriend.
She's remarried and has a child, and his life is just completely upside down.
And he even says to her, it's like, for you it's been 5 years, but for me it was yesterday. And he's trying to tell her, like, his feelings haven't changed at all. It's really, I mean, the movie is really sad.
Yeah. Like the book. The book is very sad, too. The book really pushes that whole idea to what would happen if you know, you're in love with somebody and everything's working out great, and then suddenly you go to sleep for 5 years and, you know, you wake up what feels like 5 minutes later.
The whole world is different for
everything.
You.
Everything. Yeah. Everybody's 5 years older, but you. You're 5 years older physically, but mentally you're still 5 years ago.
But he did wake up. He did end up looking a lot cooler after the accident. Yeah. Like, his hair got kind of cool and standing up. He got that cool long black coat, and he was like, you know, kind of striding everywhere with his cane. He's looking really cool.
That haunted Christopher Walken face.
Yeah, those big eyes.
Yeah.
He became more badass.
He did. So they show him in his class where he has his hair all brushed down, and he looks super
with his big
nerd.
Glasses, his big
brown
square glasses.
Suit. That was funny.
But it's in the book, I remember that a big part of it was that whole dealing with the 5-year coma thing, which is fascinating. And it was beautifully written in the book, of course, the idea of that. I mean, the drama just inherent in that. I mean, you could imagine a really great Stephen King book that was about nothing more than somebody being in a coma for mm-hmm. 5 years yeah. and waking up. Yeah. That would have been a great book, probably, if it was written by King.
Yep.
But this one has the added idea of when he wakes up, he has this, you know, this weird ability. And interestingly, on a you know, production from a production thing, I read that the way in the scenes where Christopher Walken touches someone and gets this big blast of psychic visual data into his, like, pumped into his brain immediately, blasted into his head, and he sees these things. Apparently Cronenberg wanted that to be really like a painful shock when the information is uploaded so quickly. And the way he achieved that on the set, apparently, from what I read, was that he had a pistol on the set with a blank gun, and that whenever Christopher Walken would grab somebody or touch somebody, it would fire the gun on the set, so all of the actors would feel this, you know, like boom, kind of a shock. And so that's why they all seem to react at the same time. And
it's a hard reaction to get, but when you do that, you really get a legitimate, you know,
everybody,
shake,
yeah,
a volt.
Everybody jumps at the same time. It's not like some sort of, like, oh, it's out of sync or something. You get everybody reacting simultaneously.
That's really funny.
Well, when he gets out, you know, gets out of the coma and recovers, the town that he lives in, there's been some unsolved murders, and so Tom Skerritt, who plays the sheriff, asks him if, you know, maybe you could help out. And he does. And there's some really cool stuff there. I love that whole scene in the gazebo in the park.
That was really
beautiful.
Well done.
Yeah. And that's a whole nother story, too. That's right. Another storyline. There's a few interesting storylines.
And there's a third story with a politician who's yeah. running for senator of the state, played
by Martin Sheen. So
yeah.
great.
And, yeah, he's just...
He's so smarmy and perfect. Yeah. And it's funny, too, because, you know, he was in the West Wing and he was like, you know, the world's greatest president. You just right. love him. And it's funny to see him play the gross politician that we feel like we have today
right.
in politics. And it's like so perfect now. It's really, it feels very relevant right
it
now.
It does. It does. But I think
it's like, what would you do if you could change something like that?
Exactly. Yeah. But the scene at the end that, you know, the magazine cover, I think if our current president did that, he'd probably get away with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
And the missiles. that's
all I thought of when I saw that.
Holding up, yeah.
The missiles are flying, hallelujah thing, too, is a classic moment where it's all that sort of hyper-religious thing that, and, you know, that's another thing that Stephen King puts in his work a lot of times is this sort of religious zealots, you know, the people that are, you know, these crazy zealous people for religion. I mean, Carrie's mother, and then in this, Christopher Walken's parents, his mother, I think is mm-hmm. hyper religious, like, you know, really fundamentalist. And then the politician, Martin Sheen politician guy is, I think it, you know, probably like a lot of those types of politicians, it's all fake, you know, but he's using religion as a, you know, as a tool.
Yeah.
But Christopher Walken gets insight into these things, into this murder and into this politician. And that's the bulk of the story, is him dealing with this insane information. And what do you do if you find out somebody's going to do something horrible? How do you, you know, how do you stop them? It's the idea of, if you could go back in time, would you kill Hitler?
Yes.
Yeah.
I like, too, the storyline they played into where Johnny, you know, Christopher Walken, Johnny goes and he kind of hides away in a small town, and he's a teacher and he tutors students at his home because he doesn't want to be around people, because if he touches people, he gets these jolts all the time. He never knows when they're going to happen. So I like this sort of the sad, lonely life where he's like rattling around, and it's like Christopher Walken looking so gaunt and fragile, right? So that rich dude comes over and wants him to teach his kid. And so he agrees, but then he gets a vision that the kid's going to drown.
Right.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Then he's
the
all
ice.
Freaking out about it. But, you know, what was another interesting, I was making another point, is that when he's in his house and they're building that Stilson campaign poster right outside his window, which
right.
is Martin
yeah.
Sheen's poster,
mm-hmm.
and he gets a knock on the door, and it's some guy shilling for Stilson going, you know, oh, he's going to be great. Let me tell you about our candidate. And he's like, I don't really have time. I'm tutoring. You know, this is a rich kid's son is back there watching. You know, he goes, Johnny, are you okay? What's going on? And then, sure enough, here comes Johnny's ex-girlfriend, you know, Brooke Adams, comes walking up, and it's her husband at the door.
Yeah.
And it's all like, oh, hi, this is my husband. And you could just see Christopher Walken just collapsing on the inside. Yeah. It's probably the saddest, most devastating thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And he does this great gesture where he finally closes the door, and he puts his arm out, and the kid's like, Johnny, Johnny. He just puts his hand out and just sort of falls against the door, and oh, it just makes me want to cry when I think about it. It's so sad. And she's all smiling, and he's like, oh, I can't take it.
Nobody shatters like Christopher Walken.
He does so good. He does.
It has Anthony Zerbe plays the rich guy, and he's an always interesting actor. You know, he always kind of plays a creepy guy.
Yeah.
And this one, you thought he was kind of a good guy, but then you realize, you know, he's the coach of the hockey team, and he goes, get out there and play, you know. So, but I think it's just a small movie that works with big emotions.
Funny. I watched it recently. You know, I'd seen The Dead Zone a bunch of times. It's one of my favorite ones. And when I watched it this time recently, I never really knew what The Dead Zone meant until I watched it this time. I didn't realize that The Dead Zone was a little blank spot in Johnny's visions where it can change.
Right.
Like, I thought Dead Zone was kind of like, oh, he goes to this place and sees visions. No, it's not the visions. It's the place and the visions that mean you can change it. There's like this unseen part.
Well, see, I didn't. Like I totally missed that too.
Yeah, so
I think that's
like,
just in the book, though. Did they have that
they
in the movie?
No, they said
it
in the movie.
Oh,
so explain it again. So it's not when he's zoning out.
When he zones out, he sees a vision. In his vision, there's sort of an area that's like dark or black that he can't see. Like
unclear,
like kind
this sort of fuzzy,
of
blurry,
a blank part, which means it's an area that can be shifted to and changed.
I got you.
So when he sees the vision, he knows if he, like when he saw the girl burning in the house in the very beginning, he was able to get the, you know, the mother home to save the daughter. So the daughter didn't die as in his vision.
Same with the kids playing hockey.
So in the hockey thing, that's when I think that's even when he realized it. He goes, oh my God, I can change things. You know, I can see a future and I can change it. That's when he gets the idea, when he realizes after he shakes hands with Stilson that he's like, basically the Antichrist. He's going to like destroy the world with another world war.
Right.
So he's like, I could change this. I got to stop this guy. Right. So that's sort of the impetus that he knows he can change it.
And that heavy, heavy responsibility that's laid on him to save the world, knowing that, you know, if he does this horrible thing that he has to do to save the world, he will be seen as a murderer.
And he really, Johnny at this point has nothing to lose.
I was just going to say that.
His life sucks.
Yeah.
His girl is gone.
Right.
She has a baby.
He doesn't want to live this life. You know?
Yeah, and he hates being that way.
Right.
Oh, and also, let's talk about Brooke Adams and all her wisdom. I understand why her character went to him that one day.
Yeah.
She goes to his house with the baby, and he's like, oh, she's visiting. And then she's like, well, let's just pick up where we left off. And she basically is there.
This is after his coma, though.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's after his coma. And he's just rattling around his father's house, like trying to figure out what to do.
Right.
And she goes to him because she knows, I mean, you know, he still has feelings for her and that she's moved on. But she shows up at the house with the baby anyway and sleeps with him, like to kind of give him closure, I think, because he always felt like they were saving it for marriage in the beginning.
Right.
So she's like, let's do it. And so after that, she's like, this won't happen again. Bye. And I'm like,
I know.
What? That did not help him
I
at
know.
All.
That's what I was like.
It's
why
a weird
is
choice.
She? Yeah, that was a weird choice by her. I didn't get
and
why she would even go there for that one night.
I kind of see, like, he had so much yearning. I mean, I kind of see it. But when she tells, when they go out to her car and she's leaving and she's about to tell him that it's, you know, not going to happen, he looks so hopeful. He has that sort of hollowed out kind of hopeful, like, so, like, things are different now. Like that, oh, it's just heartbreaking to watch. And then she, you know, puts the hammer down and goes, nope. Bye. It's like,
and nobody does hollowed out like Christopher Walken.
He's just the best.
But I just don't get why she would do that. Like, it just, I mean, it's one thing to say, okay, it's closure, but it's more like opening up. It's not closure. It's opening up an option for him that he doesn't have.
I just think
it was kind of cruel.
Yeah, cruel.
You know? I think she thought she was doing a nice thing, but it wasn't.
Well, yeah, she's not a cruel person.
And
but
she stayed the night, right? I mean, did she stay the night? I
totally felt that way.
So,
but that's the kind of thing that's going to make somebody fall in love with you, you know, if you're doing that, then she's giving him hope. She basically was saying, yeah, we can.
Because she didn't age one second.
Yeah.
It's only been five years.
Change your hairstyle.
Yeah.
Everything's good. And she should, I mean, this is totally off, off topic, but she should have definitely played in the Karen Carpenter story.
Yeah.
Oh, I know. She
My
looks so much.
Goodness gracious.
Yeah, Brooke Adams looks just like her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so then, so here we have Johnny with nothing left to lose. You know, he has no girlfriend. He has, you know, he feels like his only mission now, the reason he has this power is to probably stop this guy.
Well, he accidentally, I think the politician is going along shaking hands with everybody at one point, you know, politician style. And he shakes hands with Johnny, who has the shine, you know, or whatever it is in this.
The shine.
He's got the magical Stephen King mind reading ability. And when Christopher Walken shakes hands with him, he gets this vision of this politician winning the election and becoming president and starting a horrible war and, you know, just being the worst president ever.
And Greg Stilsing and Martin Sheen's character also feel something.
Yeah.
Like
this horrified
on?
Look like, oh, I've been found out.
Yeah,
or
even
something.
He doesn't know what he's going to do, but he's like, something's up.
Yeah.
But that does I think everybody he touches who he does that with, I think they all feel sort of a shock, it seems like.
Yeah, it's like almost like electric shock traveling between them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But I love that line in the vision with Stilson, who's wanting to set off nuclear armed missiles.
Yeah.
And the one, his one advisor doesn't want to touch the screen. I love the David Cronenberg screen, too. It was like super primitive, like a black box with a screen on
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
It's like just like made out of cardboard.
And a weird little switch or something.
Yeah.
So they have this like, you know, panel that's just changing, you know, green and red. And,
right.
But he's like, if you don't put your hand on the scanner, I'm going to cut it off and put it
yeah.
for
yeah.
you. And he's like, okay, I won't do it. That was really funny.
That's right, the hand scanner.
And his right-hand man, henchman guy, was just like, you know.
Oh, he was great.
He was great. He was like creepy and had this look on his face, you know.
Leather jacket. Looks like he was the guy that would go, like, take care of problems.
In a David Cronenberg movie.
In a David Cronenberg movie. In a very body-conscious way.
I also like the setting. Wherever it was filmed, I'm assuming it's Canada, but I don't know.
It's definitely Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely.
You can tell Cronenberg movies because the sky is always white or gray. And everything, never blue skies. It's always this white, dreary, overcast day.
And the contrast with his characters dressed in black, like that black coat you were talking about that Christopher Walken wears. There's a scene where, that scene where he's in the tunnel.
Yes.
And he's wearing that coat. And it's just, it's such a great, it's almost like Nosferatu in the old silent film, you know, it's impressionistic. It's really beautiful. But a lot of Cronenberg movies do have that dead trees on the white sky and kind of ugly in some ways, but he does it properly. It's ugly for a reason. You know, the
there's a drab quality. I don't know.
Yeah,
there's something about it that doesn't, there's not a lot of life there.
But it adds to the feeling of the film instead of making it look uninteresting. It actually, he shoots these sort of drab office parks and industrial areas in a way that works with the story and the feeling. And of course, Howard Shore's music on top of that stuff really puts you there. And then you feel the cold of Canada.
Well, I feel it. Go ahead.
I was going to say that scene in the tunnel. I was just going to bring that up. Is that I love how the sheriff comes to get Johnny to help him with the murder case, you know, missing girl or the murder girls. And you were talking about like that great scene of him walking. He has this sort of new confidence. Like, I'm going to help this guy. You know, I'm going to use this power for good. He's got this whole thing, and he's walking down there. He's got that black coat flapping. He's got that cane. They're walking on this slushy, dirty snow. They come into end, and he doesn't feel anything. And it's just like, And you're all anxious, too. Like, are you going to feel it? And then the sheriff's kind of, you see him kind of crestfallen, like, crap, it was worth a try. And it's, And then when they go walking back, when you know, just happens to touch the deputy and gets the jolt.
Yeah.
Right.
And then he sees that whole great gazebo scene where they put him in the scene and he's watching the murder happen.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's sort of seeing the murder happen and not being able to stop it to just watch the slaughter. I think that's sort of where it breaks Johnny, basically, where he goes, I can't do this.
I think it's the best scene in the movie.
So good. So he just was like, it's him. It's the sheriff's like, who, what? It was really.
And they go back to his house, and he's in the bathroom.
And so then Johnny's getting mail, all this mail of people. Help me find my children. Help me find my, you know, the one who murdered my son. You know, he's getting, and he has a closet full of the sad mail from people wanting him to help, and he just can't.
And that breaks his heart. It's a really great movie with so many different things about it that are great. It's not just one story that goes from beginning to end. It's like a series of. Mm-hmm. Stories about what would happen if somebody suddenly had this power, and you know, some movies you watch that about a certain topic, you come away from it thinking, God, they should have explored it more. They should have gone more into what it would be like to feel this way. But this one really digs in to the ideas behind if you had a special power, it's not all good. It's not like suddenly I have this power, I can do anything. It's like, no, you're haunted. In some ways, it's a lot like Cronenberg's film Scanners, where there was a guy who had this special mental power, very much like Johnny's, but different in a way.
Didn't go well.
And it doesn't go well. But in that movie, they pushed the idea that if you could read minds, how horrible would that be? You know, what's the downside? I would not want to read minds. And first of all, the idea of not being able to control it, and you get those scenes and Scanners where he's in the crowd of people, they bring in more and more people, and he keeps hearing more and more voices until it's just this rushing, screaming noise in his mind of everybody's thoughts. So the guy is literally just being driven insane by his own psychic power, much like the guy in the Dead Zone is, you know, it sounds like it would be great to be able to help people and to touch somebody and know something about them and be able to help them. But like you were saying, he's got a closet full of letters. He can't help everybody.
And it seems to be taking something out of him. Like, I love the scene, too. Like, this is like where Cronenberg, he doesn't just like craft a scene. He crafts an entire movie. So here we have this broken, shattered Christopher Walken. He's really quiet and introverted and so passive and just, you know, just quiet little mouse all the time. And then there's that great scene where he goes to tell the rich guy about the ice breaking and all the people dying when they fall through the ice. And I love where he just yells like this, just, the ice is gonna break. It's like you haven't heard Johnny like this at all ever. And you're just like, whoa. It was so stunning to hear that. I just loved that conviction.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, like, why would you not listen to that?
Exactly.
It was so good.
One other thing, you know, you read a Stephen King book and then you imagine it in your head as what the setting is and the characters. And so then you'll see the adaptation and you go, boy, they're way off. You know, that's happened a lot.
Yeah.
But I remember reading this and seeing it right when it came out. I mean, it was very quick for me.
Yeah.
And they captured the feeling of the book as far as the setting and the characters really well.
Yeah.
And it was just like, boy, this really feels like the book.
Just had this quiet, icy movie.
Yeah, like this feels like what I read in many ways, you know. Yeah.
As far as Stephen King adaptations go, it really does have one of the best, it's one of the best examples because it really does have that feel that you got when you read the book.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure. I mean, with Carrie, I love the movie Carrie and I love the book Carrie, but there's a little bit of difference between the book and the movie.
Where De Palma's going to put in De Palma stuff.
Yeah.
Which is not, that's not what you're reading when you're reading Carrie. You're
right.
Reading all those, you know, great set pieces and stuff. That's just not what you're thinking.
But I like Brian De Palma, so it's a great combination of, you know, I like this filmmaker, I like the writer, and as with the Dead Zone, too, it's like a great writer and a great filmmaker together. And then,
speaking of,
should we switch over to another movie, the David Cronenberg?
Cronenberg Show.
The David Cronenberg episode.
And there'll be more because there's so many good Cronenberg movies. I know,
there's so many movies. So.
Yeah, we'll come back to him. But Dead Ringers is a movie that when I saw it when it came out, and it was like, this is one of my favorite movies, and it still is. It still holds up. Watched it again recently. And I was thinking, maybe, you know, I haven't seen it in years. This one might not hold up, but it really does. It was actually better than what I remembered.
Good acting is good acting.
Yeah.
So
Jeremy Irons.
We start with that, with Jeremy Irons, you know, playing the twin brothers.
Well, I love that he got an Oscar for a movie the next year, but he actually thanked Cronenberg up in his speech for winning an Oscar actually for Dead Ringers, which is what he should have won for.
Right.
I remember
so
that.
So I love that he gave a shout out to Cronenberg when he won an Oscar for a different movie. That was pretty great.
Well, he can't help but look at that film and say, wow, I'm a great actor. You know, that was great. Because he plays two people in this film. And it was made during the days before a lot of special effects were able to put two of the same person in the shot. You know, it's fairly easy to put two of the same person in the shot to make it look like identical twins. But back in those days, they had to do a lot of trickery and things. There's a lot of special effects work that had to be done to synchronize the performances, and every shot that has Jeremy Irons in it with himself playing his twin brother very meticulously planned and very hard to stage and block and orchestrate. And there had to be a lot of rehearsals. And they had stand-ins who were dressed identically to do over-the-shoulder shots. So in the foreground, you would see sort of a blurry back of a head. And you would see, and then they would cut away, and then they would have a person in the other wardrobe as the blurry back of the head, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to do that kind of thing back then.
Yeah.
Well, it's so good that, like, after 5 or 10 minutes, you forget about, oh, this is the same actor. And it's, you know, it's just, you just get into the story so quickly. And you can also easily identify who's who.
Yeah.
Like, Beverly is Beverly. That's one of the brothers' names, yeah. Beverly. And I forgot the other brother's name.
Elliot.
Yeah.
Which was interesting because both names were kind of feminine. Yeah. One was Ellie and one was Beverly.
Yeah. Well, his girlfriend brings that up in the movie. Yeah. Remember when he kicks her and he says, what are you trying to imply, that I'm gay?
And I love that, you know, they're basically gynecologists and they both have these female names and they're all steeped in, like, the female body and anatomy. That's their whole deal.
And one of them is very sort of, you know, a ladies' man type, or thinks he is, and the other one is exactly the opposite. You know,
he's the studious one. He's the one that does all the work,
right?
Yeah.
And they meet Jean-Vie Bugeaud, who plays one of the patients. She's like an actress, and she goes out with one of them, but she has no idea that they're twins.
It's so funny.
So it's
but
crazy.
Interestingly, there's a shot where she says, you have issues, you have problems, I think that you might be schizophrenic.
She was noticing a difference in their character, which is really funny because they're trading her back and forth,
right?
It's really gross,
right?
Yeah.
And you know, she's a smart person, and she kind of figures some things up, so she sets up a meeting where she meets both of them for dinner, right?
He kind of blows his cover in a scene that's really interesting too, where he's saying something, and he what does he say? Is like something like, that's something my brother would say, and she's like,
you didn't tell me you had a brother. Oh, didn't I?
And he's like, oh, we're not very close.
Right.
And she's like, well,
I want to meet him.
Really? Where does he live? And finds out that they live together. And like, wait, you're not close, but you live together. And then she meets her friend in the tea room. And her friend says, oh, you don't know about the infamous mantle twins and how they share their girlfriends and all this kind of stuff. And they're everyone knows, you know.
And, you know, the movie is originally titled Twins.
Yeah.
I always wonder, like, why you would change it. Because Dead Ringers, to me, is sort of a confusing title. I mean, it sort of makes sense, but you're like, Dead Ringers.
Well, didn't Twins, there was another movie, Twins, with Schwarzenegger and
Danny DeVito.
But, I mean, I think it was came out the same time.
It did, around the same time, I think.
It was probably one of those deals, you know.
So, but, yeah, Dead Ringers, I think, kind of has more of a... You know, it kind of tells you a little bit more about what this movie is about. It sounds more like a horror film or kind of a bit of a downer film, but it's not a happy film.
Well, so clinical, but they had some great flourishes. Like, I loved all the red, you know, the in surgery, like the sheets over the patient and the surgical scrubs was all this burgundy, the blood red, and it just was so dramatic. You know, this is like way before its time. Like, this right now, it's like something that, you know, American Horror Story would be doing all the time.
Right.
It's like, he did it first.
I remember when it, you know, came out in 88, I remember just seeing some of the, you know, the implements, like in some, you know, some press release shots of the stuff that they were using and like those weird designs, and freaked me out.
It was really,
I was
freaky.
Like, ooh, that's a ooky, you know, like
the tools.
Yeah. And so the tools that this, this artist, I guess this, you know, guy designed.
Who was
played
by the guy from
Scanners, Stephen Lack.
Oh,
yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Canadian actor.
That's
so.
Right. Yeah,
so anyway,
here are
the
these brothers, and they meet a woman,
right?
And she sort of causes a little rift because one of them, they really start falling in love with her. Of course, it'd be Elliot because he's the sensitive one.
But one of them, I feel like one of them falls in love with her. The other one is just using.
No, the other
her.
One doesn't
no,
care at all.
Elliot is the ladies' man. Beverly
is
the sensitive
one. So Bev
one.
Is getting all like, you know, into it, and it's causing a problem because now he's having trouble sharing her, and the brother doesn't care anyway. And he's kind of like, "You're gonna blow this."
And they do blow it, like Burke mentioned.
They blow
and then
it big time.
They say, well, I demand that I meet you for dinner, you know.
Yeah, so
and
then they decide to meet her.
Yeah.
And that's a great scene. That's
a great scene.
Really great acting from her. She's like, I think he offers her a drink and she says, no, I want to be completely sober for what I have to say here.
I love too, because here you have Jeremy Irons sitting next, you know, they're in the same restaurant and they're in the same scene, and you have the Beverly character's all worried. He has his hair's a little more ruffled, not a lot, but they don't overdo like the costume. Like, didn't give him glasses to make him look more different, you know. And then here comes Elliot, you know, the smarmy sort of Wall Street looking one. He's super slick and his hair's all, you know, pushed back. And he just has this lofty sort of attitude.
He sits up straighter.
So well done. And you can totally tell who's who.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's just, you know, the things he says to her, I can't remember, but there's some like withering insults.
He goes, I was the one who fucked you first. Yeah. And I gave you to my baby brother because you weren't very good.
Right.
What a sweet man.
Such an ass.
She dumps a drink in his face, I think.
A sweet talker.
And he just looks over at his brother and says, I told you this was a bad idea.
And then she says, that's the most disgusting thing that's ever happened to me. And of course he comes back at her, I doubt it.
I doubt that.
He was so great. Yeah. Such an asshole. It was so great. I just can't imagine.
And she just stomps out. And then, of course, you know, Beverly starts to cry.
He's devastated.
And he's like, and his brother is like, wait a minute, why are you crying? And he says, I guess I just feel bad, you know?
So
he says, well, I'll just go run after her and tell her it was all my fault. No.
So then Beverly starts to spiral.
Oh, big time.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to remember what, besides he was, oh, she was the impetus because she liked to do drugs. She was kind of into it. So she kind of starts getting him hooked on drugs.
Right. She's an actress and had to work long hours.
Yeah,
and
so she's getting him kind of hooked on stuff. So he starts having a problem.
And then he's a doctor.
He's shooting up in his office, you know, while waiting on patients, you know, and he's got a needle up his arm.
He's not.
And his secretary comes in and catches him shooting up.
I quit.
He doesn't even try to hide from her. And she says,
I don't think I can do this anymore.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
And then they have a few excruciating scenes, especially for women, where they have him as a gynecologist examining women in the stirrups.
Yeah.
And the scene where the woman's obviously in pain, he's doing something weird to her.
Oh,
and she's like, what are you? And he's like, just hold still. Like, he's being really rude to her and very cold. And she's all like, but it kind of, she's trying not to wince because she really needs his help. But she's like, this isn't feeling right. And then you find out later he was actually using a trophy to examine her with.
Oh, it was a retractor for corpses. It was like his brother said, don't use this on living patients.
It was like just a thing that just like pries people open, like your chest. It was really bad. So then he decides he needs his own equipment because this is just faulty equipment,
right?
Obviously. So he gets that artist. He starts commissioning an artist to make really twisted, creepy looking.
An artist named Anders Wallach. Played by Stephen Lack.
Oh, that's
and nice. Those implements really freaked me out.
They were very
that
creepy.
Made me not want to watch the movie when it first came out. I said, I don't think I want to. What are they going to do with these things?
You know, they're very Cronenberg looking.
So Cronenberg. And I love it. They have the surgery. You know, they pull the tray over, and there's a patient on a table, and they whip the, you know, cover off the tray, and all of the assistants and the surgeons in the room look down at the tray and go, What
are those things?
And he's asking for certain equipment, and she's like, I don't know what this is. And he's grabbing it, and he's tearing into patients.
It's the one on the left. He's like, I will point to it, and you hand it to me.
It was so horrifying.
And then he just goes nuts, and I think just cuts the patient.
There's blood everywhere, and they kick him out, and they try to salvage.
He's lost his mind, and he barricades himself into his office and just makes it into this sort of hoarder's nest in there, and while his brother is off doing speeches and talks. And
his brother kind of almost in a way starts feeling his, like, he's
sympathetic. Yeah.
So he starts researching how to bring him, like, detox him.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they go into their fancy, you know, penthouse apartment, it's just a total, like, just trash, just food. And
it's their
stuff
office.
Everywhere.
I think he's living in the office.
Both, I think, get trashed.
Oh.
Yeah. Definitely the office gets trashed. I know that for a fact. And then, it's just interesting how Elliot feels Beverly's pain.
Yeah.
You know, there's that connection.
Sympathetic addiction that he starts to take on his brother. And they start, it's almost like they start losing the definition between themselves.
And
they
start losing it, too.
Yeah.
Like, I start, like, which one's which now? Like, I love that you can't really tell.
Mm-hmm.
And they reference the original Siamese twins, Chang and Aang, two Thai brothers who were interconnected, the conjoined twins. And they start the very end of the film is pretty horrific. Maybe we shouldn't talk about it without spoiler alert. But they start doing a he starts doing an operation on his brother to separate them, mm-hmm. even though they're not conjoined.
Well, because his greatest fear was that if one of them dies, it will kill the other one because they're connected.
Well, right. he has that dream, and that's that Cronenbergy.
That was the body horror.
That weird sort of pulsating
skin between them, like a organ that runs between them.
And then doesn't she's in the dream? She comes over and just starts biting it.
Right,
so gross.
Which is interesting because she is sort of like the agent of their separation. Yeah. You know, she is the one that bit the connecting fiber. You know.
But I remember when I saw this the first time, I thought it was just devastating, like a masterpiece. But I thought, I will never watch this movie again. Because it was so, the ending is so heartbreaking and horrific. Yes. So nasty. And everything about it is just, ugh. And so I thought, well, it's been years. It'll be fine to watch this again. I watched it again and go, oh my God, this has not lost any of its power. It's so intense.
Well, Jeremy Irons does such a great job of devolving mm-hmm. both characters in their own distinct way. He really, like you were saying, he really is two distinct characters in this film. Yeah. And even though he looks the same, it's obviously Jeremy Irons playing both, but he there's subtle. And also, like you were saying, they don't do these overt things like different hair color or giant glasses. It's these subtle little things because part of the idea of it is they aren't very different.
No. They're both doctors. They both wear scrubs. They dress the same in a lot of the movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They think alike. They finish each other's sentences and, you know, they're like identical cousins, you know. They're not
identical cousins.
All the way.
Or identical
all the
way. Yeah.
They both like hot dogs. The idea is that they're both so identical that people can't tell them apart and that they're blending together. And yet they both have their distinct personalities, and those distinct personalities start diffusing.
I'm still not even sure who survives the movie.
I think they both die.
I'm not sure.
I think Beverly operates on Ellie.
See, at that point, that's what was so cool, is you weren't really sure who was in charge this way.
When he wakes up, he's looking for his brother is dead behind him, and he's saying, Ellie. Ellie.
Yeah, but was he like, did he then absorb his brother?
Right.
Yeah. Like, to me, I wondered if that was intentional. That's interesting. Blurring.
Was he, did he change places
with
his brother?
Because it seemed like he kind of wanted to be his brother.
Right.
I don't know.
That's an interesting, because I definitely thought it was Beverly who was alive and Ellie who was dead.
I don't know. It's very confusing. Another thing I thought was cool when we were talking about the tech aspect of, you know, shooting over the shoulder of the person to make look like the same one in the room when it's the same actor.
Right.
And, you know, how that's hard to pull off then. And that's another part when we talk about Dead Zone, he's thinking about the whole picture, not just the scene, is that he shoots the whole movie like everyone's a twin in the movie. Like, you have a lot of direct over-the-shoulder shots of people. You have, like, you know, cutting people off at certain areas so they're more less distinct, so that when they make those plays to have the guy in the cinema, you don't really notice it because they're so used to that style.
It's the
filming.
Style of
it
the
was
movie.
Such an interesting
right.
choice.
Yeah,
it's not jarring, those scenes when they're together.
Right.
Because even when it's just like a nursing room directly from the back, you know, in this big empty room, so you're expecting a line down the little screen or something. But that's just how he shot it. So I thought that was really smart.
And it was very well technically done for those days, too, mm-hmm. because there was moving cameras. There were shots where they cross in front of each other. All these things are really hard to do with that type of process back then. It's a lot easier now.
And
but
I think it was one of the first times that had ever been done.
Yeah.
When he pulled that off.
The point is that you forget as one actor.
You stop looking for
it. That's all you care about. Yeah. That's all he cared about. I want that to go away in 10 minutes. You know.
You have to really think about the trickery,
right? Because in the beginning part, it's when they're kids, and I'm pretty sure those are twins.
Real
twins there. Yeah. Then they go to college, and it's Jeremy Irons. So
I liked the kid twins that went to the little girl.
Yeah.
And she's like, fuck off, freaks.
He goes up and he's like, will you have sex with us in our bathtub?
Fuck off, freaks.
Because they're talking about how, the reason people mate is because we don't live in water.
Yeah.
It's like, exactly. If we lived in water like the fish, we wouldn't have to mate. We wouldn't have to have sex.
That's such an, you know, a classically kind of a weird kid thing to say.
Yeah.
And kids would say something like that if they're kind of off, you know.
Yeah. Fascinated with medical processes
and
biological processes.
That was how they played doctors, actually play doctor.
But there's not a false feeling in the whole movie.
You know,
I think Jean-Pierre Bugeaud
she's
fantastic.
Great.
Yeah. So great acting.
And it was hard to kind of go opposite them because they are dominating every scene. So the fact she can hold her own with those guys is pretty
I've always liked her. You know,
yeah. She's great.
About,
yeah.
Back in the 70s, she was in lots of movies.
Yeah.
She was, and she plays such a flawed character in this too.
Yeah,
she's not really not a perfect person. She's kind of a little bit bad in the way she kind of gets him hooked on drugs or helps. I don't know. Maybe she doesn't help him not get hooked on drugs is the best way to say it.
She does not help at all.
But she's she has to leave to go work on a movie for a long time, and she's like, I'm going to be gone for months or whatever, and she leaves. But when she comes back, things are upside down with him.
I love when he calls her and he gets the assistant. He tells the assistant to do this really gross exam on her, like a kind of call. And the assistant just looks ill, and later she says, my assistant's gay, and you basically destroyed him.
Yeah. You ruined his day.
Yeah.
It was so funny. The film has its humor.
Yeah.
It's pretty grim. There's
a few bits.
There's a few little light moments.
Yeah. But, I don't know if I would characterize this movie as a film with light moments.
Not light
it's one of those movies that I think, you see it and you can really appreciate it. It's incredible.
Yeah.
But like you said, you watch it, go, I don't really need to see that one. Because it, again, for a while.
You can let 10 years go by every time you watch it.
But it really is one of those movies to watch just for the achievement of the acting. And, like you were saying, everybody in it is really good. And it's if you really love filmmaking and acting, this is a great one. This is just a great one for storytelling, seeing the sort of evolution of a character arc, even though it's a downward spiral.
It's not a good spiral.
But Jeremy Irons is so good at starting off the film in one way and gradually scene by scene. And they don't shoot films in order. I'm sure a lot of our listeners know that films are shot out of sequence. Yeah. And you have to, and I know actors, I've seen these, and I know actors will keep charts of their emotional level at certain points in the script. And they'll say, if you're shooting scene 2, and then you shoot scene 50, and then you shoot scene 4, you have to know where you are emotionally in the script.
That's
when
true.
You go back. So, they might have shot scenes near the end. They might have shot those first. And scenes near the beginning, they might have shot those last. So Jeremy Irons, I imagine, may have drawn out one of these charts that had these different phases on the chart. Like here I'm... And, I've seen actors write this down in different ways. I'm this way here, I'm this way here, I'm this way here. And using words like level from their own emotions, like things that they can relate to in their own emotions. And you have to keep track of all that.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
I don't know how you do that.
It's like makeup artists when...
And he has to do it for two different characters.
Yeah,
exactly.
The same scene.
Oh, my God. That just is such a trick.
Yeah.
But, makeup artists have to do that same thing. They have to keep track through a film if somebody keeps getting hurt,
Right.
Mm-hmm. If you get four scratches on your face over the course of the film, you have to remember, in the last scenes, which we're going to shoot first, he's already got the four scratches.
Right, so.
And so tomorrow when we shoot scene 4, I'm going to have to take it down to 2 scratches.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, it's continuity. It's half the battle.
Yeah, there's a lot more to filmmaking than a lot of people might realize.
That's for sure.
So I don't know if you guys noticed, but we love Cronenberg so much.
Yeah.
And there's so many other films to talk about.
So many.
You're
going to get so sick of Cronenberg by the time we're done with you.
Well, the interesting thing about David Cronenberg is I've seen all of his films, and there's some of his films that I remember when I saw him. I liked him okay, but I wasn't blown away. But then I watch him again recently, and Existence.
Yes.
I remember when that came out thinking there was something about it that I didn't really like as much as his other films.
It didn't seem as good as some of the other ones.
But, I watched it recently, and that's a really cool movie.
We should cover that one.
I haven't seen that ever.
I haven't seen that forever.
I've never seen that. There's a few I haven't seen.
I like it because I like the video game aspect of it.
Virtual world idea, which we all kind of know more about now. Back when the movie came out, virtual worlds weren't really a thing yet.
Yeah. I love that idea.
But now that people have played World of Warcraft and things like that, and the idea of being manifested inside an artificial environment and you're playing a game and the things that are happening aren't really happening. They really play that idea in a weird way. And in that way that I really like in movies where, okay, is this real?
Or
is this,
and so you're never sure where they are.
Yeah.
You got to jack in.
And what do you do when you do commit to a game where you're literally jacked in, your presence is in the game, and somebody can control what you're seeing in this world, and they can do anything to your character.
And what's happening to your body at the time? You're super vulnerable. Like anything could be happening.
And they can have you imagine that you're waking up.
Yes.
And you're out of the game now.
That's right. So,
but anyway, we're going to talk a lot about David Cronenberg.
We got Carpenter, we got Cronenberg, we got it all, Stephen King.
But there's what we're trying to do, and hopefully we're achieving this, is bringing up these movies that folks who are listening may not have seen in a while, or maybe you saw it years and years ago and you haven't seen it, but it's like, you know, give it another look. You might like it more now.
Or maybe you didn't see it yet. There's so many new ones, and you think, well, I don't want to see old movies, but you should.
Movies slip through the cracks.
Yep.
And stuff like that. Like, that probably had a limited run, and it was kind of gone.
Dead Ringers?
Existence.
Yeah.
And just like, you might want to, you know, I want to check it out again.
Yeah, I do too. We'll definitely cover that.
We'll put that on the list of upcoming films.
On the list.
Cover.
Thank you for the suggestion, listeners.
Yes.
We got you. We read your minds.
I think I was the caller on that one, right?
Speaking of that, you know, please, you know, check out our social network stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, please do. You can check us out at hashtag Cinemondo Pod on Twitter and Cinemondo Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. And also you can listen to us on iTunes,
Stitcher, everywhere. Yeah. You can even listen on our website, cinemondopodcast.com. I mean, there's no way to avoid us, really.
And you don't have to just tell us how great we are. You can tell us that, but also tell us what you want to hear on the show.
But don't be mean.
Yeah, don't be mean to us.
And subscribe and like and listen.
But definitely write to us with suggestions, because we love those suggestions. It's really fun.
What should we talk about? What are some, you know, sort of uncelebrated movies that you feel like don't get the credit they deserve.
I mean, don't mean stuff like Dirty Dancing, just as an aside.
Right. Well,
don't make us watch that.
Some people like movies, like I saw in one of the comments, somebody said Roadhouse. And I know.
I kind of was like, what? And I'm like,
But you know,
I saw that too.
A lot of people love that movie, Roadhouse.
I've heard that come up a lot lately.
You know what it is? I saw it. It is so over the top.
Yeah.
It's like a comedy.
All right, fine. We'll cover Roadhouse.
Well,
well, let's watch it. I mean, let's watch it.
I've seen it, and you guys can watch it.
We can do it as a No,
it's so over the top. It's so Patrick Swayze being Patrick Swayze times 100, as just a macho guy. But it's funny. It's funny. It doesn't take itself seriously. If it did, it's, you know, it's crazy. But
it has to be earnest, but just not necessarily good.
Oh, it's earnest. I think.
Oh, it's like, earnest.
I mean, earnest goes to hell.
Try and make a bad movie.
It's got, you know, it's got, who was the blues guitarist who was blind, who was, you know, played, he was
Stevie
big.
Wonder.
No, Stevie Wonder.
No.
I'm just kidding. I'm kidding.
Jeff something or other. I can't remember, but he was.
Jeff Healy?
Yes.
Oh yeah. Jeff Healy. I remember him.
He's in it, but he plays in the Roadhouse. Right. The bar is so tough that he has to play behind, like, you know, chain fence.
Oh, that's
chain
hilarious.
Chain link fence. I've played it. My band used to play bars like that.
But yeah, and there's fights every 2 seconds.
When you're playing your white supremacist bars.
Yeah. I had to kill all those Nazis that time. Oh,
nobody
wait, was
cares.
That me? That wasn't me.
No one cares if you kill Nazis.
But anyway, I'll happily watch Roadhouse, but it's you know.
But is
fun.
It artificially
it like
surreal, like in the way that we talk about movies like The Warriors or Beyond the Valley of the Dolls?
No. I mean, it's very 80s, you know, very 80s action movie. It's just so over the top, you just have to laugh at it.
Okay.
All right, fine. We'll laugh at it.
Because I know a lot of people like it because it's bad. You know, the same reason there's a lot of people.
It's a guilty pleasure kind of movie.
Like that movie Showgirls, you know. There's a lot of people who just love that movie because it's so.
So horrific.
Awful. And has such a. And like movies like Warriors and Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, it has that feeling to it like somebody made a movie about showgirls who have no idea of the reality of showgirls.
Well, have you seen Showgirls?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I only could watch half of it.
No,
yeah,
it's
hard to watch.
Was Kyle MacLachlan in that? For some reason,
I can't even tell you.
Maybe he was, but Roadhouse is much more watchable.
Okay,
you know,
okay.
It's not that, you know, just devastating to sit through. This it's very watchable. Okay. It's kind of silly.
Well, maybe,
you know.
maybe we should try. We spent a lot of time talking about it.
Ben Gazzara is a badass, so you know that's kind of fun.
Well, yeah. one of our listeners actually requested Roadhouse.
Okay.
So you know,
we're gonna do it.
Take them seriously.
Okay, fine.
They're proof to our listeners that we're listening to our listeners.
Well, it was directed by Rowdy Harrington, so he should do a Rowdy Harrington episode.
What else is Rowdy Harrington?
He did a movie with Bruce Willis. I forget what it was called, but it's set in Pittsburgh, and he plays a cop that, you know, is on a boat on the river. You know.
Oh, I remember that. Wasn't Sarah Jessica Parker?
Yes. Okay. Whatever that one was called.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Was it called Boat Cop? Bruce Willis is Boat Cop.
Paul Blart, Boat Cop 2.
River Law.
River Law.
I think yours are better. That was horrible.
Law Lake.
All right, stop it.
But, and only one man
can ride this boat.
Oh, Rowdy.
All the way home.
Only one man can steer this boat down the river.
A Rowdy Harrington film. A Rowdy Harrington film. I'll keep saying that.
Arresting bad guys.
Coming soon to a theater near you.
I'm sure you've had enough. Okay.
Yeah, I need to stop now.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Thanks for listening. Cinemondo signing out.